Good morning. 10:30 having arrived, I'm going to call this remote meeting of the House Preventing Homelessness to order. Will the clerk please take the roll?
Yes. Good morning. Chair Gomez.
Gomez present.
Gomez present. Vice Chair Keeler.
Keeler present.
Vice Chair Keeler present. Lee New Brinley.
Present.
Lee New Brinley present. Heinrich. Heinrich. Hollins.
Hollins present.
Hollins present. Hornstein.
Hornstein present.
Hornstein present. Howard.
Howard present.
Howard present. Cagle.
Cagle present.
Cagle present. Petersburg.
Petersburg present.
Petersburg present. Ryer. Ryer.
Ryer present.
Ryer present. Heinrich. Okay, we have a quorum.
Thank you so much. Next on the agenda is approval of the minutes from March 16th, 2022. Vice Chair Keeler, did you have time to review the minutes?
I did, Madam Chair. I'll move those minutes.
Excellent. So Representative Keeler moves approval of the minutes for March 16th, 2022. Any discussion? Hearing none, if we could unmute for a moment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 16th, 2022 are adopted. So Representative Davids is excused. He reached out to us beforehand. He had a conflict. We have three items on our agenda this morning. First, we're going to hear from the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness on the governor's updated supplemental homelessness response recommendations and budget. The supplement to the supplement, I think we're calling it. So joining us today is Eric Grumdahl, the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Interagency Council. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Grumdahl. If you would just say your name and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and members. For the record, my name is Eric Grumdahl. I serve as the Deputy Director for the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. We wanted to share with you two important revisions to the housing stability package of the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's supplemental budget proposals that we reviewed with you earlier this month. Those two changes were included in the revised supplemental released last Thursday. As you know, the revised supplemental budget reflects changes based on the updated fiscal forecast published by Minnesota Management and Budget. There were two changes to the housing stability package included in last week's announcement. The first of those is a $20 million increase in the governor's request for the Emergency Services Program, or ESP, administered by the Department of Human Services, bringing the total to $55 million for fiscal year 2023. That increase recognizes that there are a number of shelter settings and other homeless response programming that's been supported by temporary pandemic-related funds directed by state and local governments. Many of those programs are facing continuing high levels of demand, but are approaching the end of those sources and the possibility of needing to close the doors on shelter programs at a time when people continue to need shelter and those services. Many of the funding challenges have really only fully come to light in the past several weeks, making this increase also timely and urgent for the continuity in that programming. The second proposal has a nominal cost associated with it, $200,000, that would be directed to Minnesota Housing's budget on behalf of the Interagency Council on Homelessness, and is designed to build on the great work of the Task Force on Shelter that this committee helped establish. We are proposing to establish a new task force to focus on an even larger and possibly more complex policy issue, specifically the role of different levels of government in the response to homelessness. The pandemic showed us how incredible life-saving responses to homelessness are possible through effective coordination of resources and responses between state and county and municipal and regional and tribal public entities. This remains a policy domain with many committed partners, but without a clear and consistent set of roles and responsibilities that help guide how these partners work together. This is both a complicated problem to solve, meaning that it involves a lot of pieces, and a complex problem to solve, meaning that the problem itself is dynamic and that the pushes and pulls experienced by different stakeholders exist in relation to the roles that others are willing to play. We know that there can be good things about opt-in structures like this, a stone soup approach to solving the problem of homelessness, if you will. But we've also seen the impact for people experiencing homelessness when the answer to questions about who bears responsibility for responding to crises is unclear, and the impact to communities when well-intentioned public agencies confront new challenges or crises, needing to define those roles in the midst of the crisis. I suspect that many members of this committee can think of specific examples over the past several years where clearly defined roles might have helped focus responders on responding rather than on first needing to define those roles. Because this is a hard problem and one that has to incorporate many points of view and widely varying contexts across Minnesota, we are proposing a task force made up of stakeholders who understand that complexity, including people experiencing homelessness themselves, representatives of different public entities across levels of government, and homeless advocates and service providers. This group would be tasked with doing research into how public sector agencies respond in Minnesota today, what lessons could be drawn from roles between state, regional, local, and tribal governments and other communities across the country, and ultimately to craft recommendations for the legislature to consider. I know that this committee has discussed the responses to encampments specifically. We would see the response to encampments as one part of the scope of this task force work, but that its scope would include other dimensions of how different levels of government respond, from the provision of shelter or other crisis services to other interventions focused on the health and safety of people experiencing homelessness and the communities in which they reside. Finally, we're proposing that this group convene following completion of the shelter task force, the task force on shelter, so that it can include that task force recommendations among its inputs. This new task force would work for 1 year and then return its recommendations to the legislature. Thanks for the opportunity to share those two additions to the governor's supplemental budget proposal, and I'm happy to take any questions about those proposals. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Grumdahl. We have time for member questions now, and I'm just gonna say maybe a couple things. You know, I'm really thankful for you bringing this this effort forward. I think that when, you know, we as a committee over the last 2 years we've struggled, we've tried to kind of get our arms around what is like a very, as you said, complex and complicated issue. I think I use those interchangeably, so I'm gonna go like, I'm gonna get myself right on that. I appreciated that distinction. When Eric and Kathy and I sat down, like when I found out this was gonna be a committee, I was like, okay, like what's the most important number one thing that I can do with this tool of this committee in the legislature? And I feel like what we agreed on was to do this, right? To bring some level of coordination and conversation around it. And honestly, I haven't had the capacity to convene it because it feels really big and really like something that I would want to, you know, I did like kind of take it onto myself, right? To like think, okay, this should be the task of this committee in a lot of ways to bring this coordination. So I'm just really pleased that this is coming forward. I think this is not going to be a do nothing task force that creates a report that sits on a shelf. This is going to be a way for, you know, the people who live and breathe this work to come together and think about how it is that we can coordinate. And I also, you know, I spoke with Lead New Brindley this morning, and I really appreciate, you know, that she has introduced a bill that's kind of like about kind of more evaluation of what we are doing from the state perspective. And so I want us to think together about how to incorporate the piece that she's always kind of bringing up, like, okay, we're doing many, many things in many departments, like what's working really well, what's the highest and best use of the public resources that we have that we can bring to bear on this issue. And so I just look forward to kind of like to scoping that out, to adding that piece that she has really consistently brought up as a lens that we through which we ask this group to do their work. And so, yeah, I just want to say thank you. Leigh New Brindlin, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to say, and in fact, you know, I mean, it has felt many times like that has been how you have used this committee. And I appreciate that this committee has often been used as an opportunity to learn and to hear from lots of different groups and lots of different agencies about what they're doing. I think that's been really effective, and I really appreciate that. And I would hope that that work would continue in a working group. And I appreciate your last comments as well. I like the idea of a task force. I think that this is a good idea, especially because I think we have seen in this committee that there are places where this is being done well, maybe not perfectly, but it's being done well. And we've also seen in this committee that there are other places where it is not being done well. And we can do better. And so I appreciate that. And I hope that if this does move forward, this task force, and it does actually come to fruition and happen, I hope that we will focus on a framework. My concern is always, well, I get a little frustrated. I think, okay, well, we'll have this task force and they'll come back and they'll just tell us they need all this money to go to all these different places. And it won't actually be real solutions on how we can do it better. Because you know what? We can keep giving money for years and decades to come. But if that's all we do, we are never going to solve this problem. We are never going to make lives better for these people if that is our only solution. So I hope that as this moves forward and we provide a real framework to the task given to the task force, I hope that we will include that. Speaking to represent Chair Gomez prior to the meeting, you know, we talked about how in the Wilder presentation last week, you know, I mean, there are points at which homelessness increases. Is it just a factor of the economy? Are there policies that change? What is happening during those times? And what happens during those times that we're leveling off? And how can we do better? So I really hope that the direction given to the task force will be broader than what resources do we need? Because again, we can do that for years and decades to come, and we will never solve this problem. So I really appreciate that approach, Chair Gomez, and your thoughtfulness in how you would like to see this done. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Are there any other member questions or comments about the supplemental budget or about the task force? I am not seeing any. So thank you as always, Mr. Grumdahl, for joining us and for your work. We really appreciate you. Appreciate you being in front of us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Absolutely. All right. So now I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next on the agenda, we will once again have House File 4225 from Chair Gomez. We discussed this bill last week and ran out of time, and we believe this is a really important conversation to have. And so that is what we are going to move to. I will again move that House File 4225 be laid over. We have House File 4225. Chair Gomez, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. You all heard kind of about 4225 last week. There was just a request to continue the conversation. I've been reflecting, I guess, on my presentation of this bill last week, and Leigh New Brindlin's point was well taken. That's a lot of noise outside my window. We had, you know, a lot of a kind of big chunk of presentation and not a lot of time for conversation. And part of that was because of, frankly, like the way that I personally intersect with this issue has to do with what happened in my community in 2020. And, you know, I think that it's difficult. I mean, even now it's sort of just, it's difficult for me to be really concise and clear about it, I guess. And so I just want to acknowledge that it was that, you know, my kind of introduction to the bill, I think, was sort of like, it was sort of meandering last week. And that is a function of how affecting that time was for me and how I feel that it connects to the story of this committee. And so, you know, I think it was like an unusual hearing. It was an unusual conversation. But, you know, we all bring our experiences and our humanity to this work. And so that was kind of like where I was at last week. I mean, I didn't go back and look at it, but I thought about, you know, like the parts about like, I'm, you know, sending my son away and how that interacted with like my experience of being with people in this space in my community, where they didn't have access to shelter, and all of the things that I learned and all of the ways that I saw systems not working for them, but also just the complication of the issue, because it doesn't just, when you have an encampment in a community, it doesn't just impact the people in the encampment, it impacts the surrounding communities, it impacts our emergency response, it impacts our public safety professionals. I mean, it impacts all parts of the community. And so I think that like part of that was just the complication of this issue. Part of the reason that maybe like my thoughts about it were not focused is because I don't have a really clear answer. And so that's also sort of part of the bill kind of being in the state that it was, which was like not quite ready to move forward. But my intent with introducing it and having the conversation was just to try to get people thinking about it. And that is what happened, because I got a lot of feedback from cities, from counties, from agencies. And so, you know, I'm really looking forward to moving some of that into this process that Mr. Grumdahl just described. So I don't know if Representative New Brindley or any other members of the committee have thoughts or questions, but we have this space and time together to talk about that issue.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you for asking. And I want to say, and I appreciate our conversations offline as well. And I think as legislators, we are often frustrated. We shouldn't have to micromanage, right? And whether that is these things that should be managed at the local level or in the departments and state government or whatever it is, I think that we sometimes have frustration and feel like we need to micromanage things in a way that we shouldn't have to do. And yet balls are being dropped someplace. And as you said, and as we talked about, I think a ball has been dropped in an area where this issue has been ongoing for a long time. And we should have a solution. We should have an answer to this. And as almost everything to some extent that we do in the legislature has unintended consequences everywhere, right? Like very few things have a one size fits all approach, which is really our job at the legislature. So I completely understand where this bill is coming from, and I absolutely appreciate the intent. And I also appreciate the acknowledgement and recognition that a one-size-fits-all approach will be difficult on this issue, particularly for our rural communities who are just in a very different position as far as the problem goes and as far as the potential solutions go and having the resources to fit within this framework. So I very much appreciate the thoughtfulness with which you are approaching this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lee New Brindley. Members, I will note that we have several pieces of testimony that was included in your materials today and posted on the committee page online. We do have one public testifier that we'll move to now. Sue Watla Phillips. Is she here?
Thank you.
Please continue. You can state your name and organization and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members and Representative Gomez for bringing this bill forward. I had provided some testimony at the meeting last week, and just again want to just reemphasize a few points that I mentioned last week as we're moving forward. And I'm sorry that I'm joining you late. I had a federal congressional call that I had to be on. I think the important thing, as Representative Gomez has done, is to listen to people that are in the encampments and what they want to have happen. And what the vast majority of people want is a safe, decent, accessible home that's affordable to them, and to have the diversity of housing opportunities within our community. And as was just mentioned, is that we do have failed systems. And this has been going on and growing for the last 5 decades, not only here in Minnesota, but across the country. And so we need to recognize that we need to protect the people that don't have homes right now, and to help them get into appropriate settings that are possible for them to get into. And then that we really need to reinvest, especially the abundance that we have now with the $9.253 billion and the additional $1.2 billion in the American Rescue Plan funds, to really make the shift in the tide of affordable housing within our communities. I think some of the bills that Representative Gomez has introduced previously that passed last year with the rental assistance for family and youth is where basically through the tax committee, it then provides that local aid for communities to access to be able to have those types of flexible responses. Because one size does not fit all, as just was mentioned, is that we need to have that local flexibility to meet the variety of needs of people that are at risk or experiencing homelessness within our communities. So I think that we do need to have some standards across the state in regards to how we're dealing with encampments. I think that there is still some really good pieces in the bill, and we need to move forward on continuing to make this bill even better, because it's really important that we're not criminalizing people because they're homeless, and that we're not shoving people around like they're trash, which is what's happening when we sweep the encampments, and we're just moving people from one place to another. So I'm calling us on us and as people of faith from MICA, as executive director of MICA and president of the National Coalition for the Homeless, is that we treat people like people, that we listen to people, and that we really develop the responses utilizing this abundance of resources that we have right now to meet the needs of people in the diversity of ways that people live within our community. So thank you again for the opportunity, and happy to continue this conversation. We're working on this in communities across the country, as this is a challenge that we're meeting in many, many communities across the nation. And so look forward to continue to work with this committee and Representative Gomez on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Swatla Phillips. It's always nice to see you here. We will move to member questions and discussions. I see Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I very much appreciate this bill and this conversation, Chair Gomez. And I know I've shared this with the committee, I think once before, but I think it really bears conversation in this context, because I completely understand where Chair Gomez is coming from. In the summer of 2020, when we had there's ongoing issues with encampments in Minneapolis, but it was particularly, you know, the story that Chair Gomez said when shared with us when she was introducing the bill is very poignant. And what happened, and this is something that we experienced together, the chair and I, we noticed that a lot of the local public entities were pointing fingers at one another. And you know, whether it was the park board or the city or the county or even the state, right? Everyone was pointing fingers at one another. And it really gets to what you had said, Lead New Brindley, about balls being dropped. We witnessed that firsthand. And, you know, Chair Gomez brought a whole group of people together. I remember very well, it was at the Midtown Exchange. And some problem solving started to happen. And that's where we got the indoor villages, wraparound services, and a number of people from the encampments, you know, eventually moved into this. And it was extraordinary because this happened in a period of 6 months. And it really happened, I think, a lot because, you know, at Chair Gomez's initiative. But members, that it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't have happened that way, even though it was a success story. Had we had some policies, I think a lot of this could have been done a lot faster. And again, as Ms. Watla Phillips said, in a humane way. That small piece of the story ended well. But again, my message is it shouldn't have had to be that way. And it really took, again, Chair Gomez's initiative, and we often forget as legislators that we have a convening role in communities. It's not just about introducing bills, passing bills, this and that. And I thought, Chair Gomez, you used that convening role very effectively. But I think had we had some policies, this and many of the other crises that we're facing could, if not be avoided, could be certainly tempered and dealt with in a faster and more effective way. So I just wanted to share that, Madam Chair, with the committee.
Chair Gomez, did you want to respond?
I guess I just want to say thank you. I mean, I'm reflecting on that time. It was such a, it's hard to even remember all of the things that happened. But I remember just sort of that frustration of like, we would figure out how to get what we thought were all the right people around a table. I mean, we had a meeting where we had the mayor, the lieutenant governor, the chair of the Hennepin County Board, all of our staff. And it was like, we still couldn't kind of get there, you know? And so that was like very frustrating. And it's something that I brought back to our caucus and I brought back to our leadership and you know, that's why this committee exists. And it's why we were able to quickly move some, it was CARES Act money at that point, into the Indoor Villages project, which you're going to hear about when we talk about Hennepin County. And it's interesting because, I mean, I think that now when I look at it, I'm like, well, like that was a success, right? It was a success at the end of the day, right? Because we did have city and state and county come together and all move resources to respond with urgency to an urgent problem in our communities. But it took a lot of agitation by a lot of people. It certainly was not just me. It was a lot of people who were themselves in encampments, people who were providing services to those folks on the front line. Our park board, which kind of got thrust into this position of being frontline homelessness response, even though that is really far outside of their charge as people who kind of are in charge of recreation and programs for kids and stuff, but also a public landowner in our city. So I guess I just appreciate the reflection and my hope, and I don't want to put too much pressure on our on the task force, but just is that we will get to a point where, you know, when there is an emergent issue, because unfortunately I think we may continue to see emergent issues around this, both in the urban core and our regional population centers, as we hear frequently in this committee, that we won't have weeks or months of finger pointing and trying to figure out who's in charge of what. So thank you so much, Chair, for just bringing me back to that and for your reflections on that time together. And thank you for your partnership and for being there and for how much you obviously care and that you mobilized a lot in your life and in your network to make that situation better. So I appreciate it. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
On to, I see, Rep. Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to kind of follow up with the discussion we have around the failure of bureaucracies that can happen. And from the outside, as I started getting into politics, it was always evident. I was a church administrator for a while too, and it seemed like whenever we have policies, they tend to become more strict and more less of a discretionary piece, and yet it is through that discretion that they may or may not have that allows all agencies to become more nimble, fast acting to the issues that are coming in front of them. And so I just would say that when we develop policies, we should think about how we can also allow for some discretion and nimbleness in those policies to allow for things to happen. With that, of course, comes the possibility of misuse and mistakes made, et cetera. And so you have to kind of weigh that from one to the other. But In order for a lot of these agencies who are under strict rules and regulations, it does make it difficult for them to go beyond that unless, as you did, Madam Chair, convene on the state level, kind of giving them authority to do so. They tend to be limited by the rules and regulations that we put in place. And so that's just something for us future to think about when we put together the policies. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Petersburg. Are there any other comments, discussion? We'll give it a second. Seeing none, Chair Gomez, final closing comments.
Yeah, I guess I just want to I want to thank the committee members for their input and their thoughtfulness on this issue. And I want to thank Lead New Brindley for asking us to hold this bill over and continue the conversation and continue thinking about this. I think that it felt like some kind of fate that we have this bill in our possession. And then I was like I got briefed by the governor's office and I was like, wait, maybe we can kind of just incorporate some of this discussion into that bigger conversation. And so I'm really thankful for their openness to that. And what is really true at the core of this, right, is that nobody should be living in a tent. Nobody should be sleeping in a place that's not fit for human habitation. Like, people who are out on the streets are our brothers and our sisters and our relatives and our loved ones, and they deserve more dignity than sleeping outside and being continually pushed around. And so that's like what we're doing here, is we're trying to think about how it is that we can meet the needs of these beloved members of our community who are not disposable to us and who we just care deeply about. And so I thank us for bringing that into this conversation. And I think that we all keep that at the center of this work all the time, but I'm just kind of saying it for myself. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, for your continued passion and drive for us to have these really, really important conversations. Hearing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House File 4225 be laid over. With that, I will hand the virtual gavel back to Chair Gomez.
Thank you so much, Madam Vice Chair. Last on the agenda, we have House File 4427, which is a bill that Representative Feist is bringing to us. It was referred to our division from the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. We're going to, we are ahead of schedule, which is not our normal way that we have operated in this committee. So that's exciting. So we have time for conversation. We heard from Ramsey County, I think it was 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. So this is sort of the Hennepin County has a similar issue with kind of different specifics. And so we thank them for being here. And so House File 4427 is in front of us. Representative Feist, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before COVID-19 struck, the Twin Cities region was grappling with surging homelessness. The pandemic exacerbated the problem, but also brought new resources to address it. Its partnership with state, local nonprofits, and federal funding, Hennepin County has invested significantly to fund homelessness solutions in an effort to prevent homelessness and move Minnesotans out of homelessness. Hennepin County has focused their investment on deeply affordable housing for those with the lowest income and people experiencing homelessness. They committed $91 million in American Rescue Plan funding toward homelessness programs and affordable housing development used by nonprofit partners to boost existing programs and expand new ones. Of that, $45 million has gone to shelters and support services programs to swiftly move people out of homelessness to new housing opportunities. However, the massive investment is primarily with one-time money. Hennepin County's increased investments in services face a financial cliff when the ARP funds end in 2024. Homelessness is a statewide problem and it needs a statewide solution. State supplemental funding is needed to maintain the shelter service models
that better serve people entering homelessness. House File 4427 will provide the ongoing sustainable funding needed to improve shelter operations and homeless response to ensure that we have no gaps into the future. And next, I will turn it over to the presenters who can provide a lot of information about these efforts and the really incredible success that they've had and why they want to make sure that these efforts continue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Feist, for the introduction. And we do have some testifiers with us today. First, welcome back to the committee, Commissioner Conley. Thank you so much for being with us again. If you could just introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony, that would be great.
Thank you so much. So thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Angela Conley, and I am a Hennepin County Commissioner. On the board, I am the chair of the Health and Human Services Committee, and it's a pleasure to be with you this morning. First, I'd like to give a special thank you to Representative Feist for authoring this very important legislation, and I thank you all on this committee for all of your work on behalf of Minnesotans. When I testified before this committee earlier this year, I spoke about the historic investments we, the counties, cities, and the state, nonprofits, and federal government made to prevent homelessness and support persons and families experiencing homelessness. The pandemic has revealed the depth of racial and economic disparities in housing affordability and in access to housing. And federal relief funds created an unprecedented opportunity to ramp up investments and make significant progress to prevent and move Minnesotans out of homelessness. At Hennepin County, our vision for our services continuum is to ensure that homelessness is rare, brief, and non-recurring, and that all residents have equitable access to increased housing stability. And we do this by minimizing new entries to homelessness, increasing transitions from homelessness into permanent housing, and financing affordable housing that you just heard about, $90 million investment, along the housing continuum. Deeply affordable housing is the fundamental issue here. We administer $146 million every year toward our vision. Hennepin County has committed $91 million in American Rescue Plan funding toward homeless services and affordable housing development to be used by nonprofit partners to enhance existing programs and expand new ones. Hennepin County invested $46 million of American Rescue Plan funds towards equitable housing recovery. That includes investments in deeply affordable housing areas, such as single room occupancy facilities, down payment assistance, and increased rental construction. And we've made an investment of $45 million in shelters and support services programs to swiftly move people out of homelessness and into new opportunities. And some of those investments include early intervention and assistance for people as they enter the system, low barrier shelters and modern purpose-built shelters, 24/7 hours of operation for existing shelters, something that just didn't exist before, housing-focused case management to really help people in shelters and unsheltered settings move into permanent housing and retain the housing. And we still have that looming fiscal cliff. Hennepin County's increased investments in support services carry through to the end of the federal stimulus period and face a financial cliff when the ARP funds end in 2024. Hennepin has a network of shelters in need of state investment in capital and in support services, including continued services for Evivo Villages, which is the low barrier 100 dwelling units and coordinated support services, and American Indian Community Development Corporation Homeward Bound 50-bed shelter, which provides culturally specific services for the Native American community, and capital needs at the Simpson Shelter and St. Stephen's. This is a statewide issue. Homelessness is a statewide issue, and we need statewide solutions. With the state's continued partnership, we will provide these services. Hennepin consistently has seen that one-third of people who are using single adult shelters had a last permanent residence outside of Hennepin County, and that this is typically between 1,500 and 2,000 people each year. So I just want to wrap up here. House File 4427 will provide the ongoing sustainable funding needed for shelter operations and homeless response to ensure that we have no gaps as these programs progress into the future. You'll hear from some testifiers after me that will speak to the specifics of Hennepin County's work and the services provided at these shelters. So I just want to, again, thank you for the opportunity to share with you all about what we at Hennepin are doing to ensure that homelessness is rare, brief, non-recurring, and hopefully someday non-existent. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us again, Commissioner Conley, and thank you for all of your work. You know, thank you for Hennepin County's work and just for your personal commitment to this issue and all of the care and compassion that you bring to thinking through this really complex issue that we're all working on. So thank you for being with us. Next, Mr. Hewitt, welcome back to the committee. David Hewitt's joining us as our next testifier. If you would just introduce yourself again for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is David Hewitt. I'm the Director of Housing Stability at Hennepin County. I'm providing some more context and detail for the item in front of you here. I am also my own tech support, so bear with me for a second as I share my slides. You should now have in front of you a slide. I see nodding heads, so I will progress. Thank you. So just about 2 years ago today, on March 17th, Hennepin County stood up new fully operated shelters in hotels and moved in more than 100 people who were experiencing homelessness and aged 60 and above, and therefore at greatest risk from the then brand new pandemic. That was the very first week of our emergency response, and we believe we were the second community in the entire country to take that step after only King County on the West Coast. Over the course of that first year, we expanded these programs, ultimately sheltering 1,137 people who were senior or who had the underlying medical conditions that put them at greatest risk. We believe this saved lives. Just over a year ago today, our Healthcare for the Homeless team were ramping up, rolling out vaccinations. And at that time, we had 540 people who were senior and medically high risk from COVID in hotel shelters at a cost of approximately $16.5 million per year. At that point, we set a new course to end the use of these programs that were ultimately unsustainable and that were managing rather than ending people's homelessness, and do so without mass returns to congregate shelter or unsheltered settings. We created a team of housing-focused case managers and implemented strategies that we knew to be effective from our efforts to reduce veteran and chronic homelessness. Today, we do not have a single person in a hotel shelter. We closed the final site earlier this month, and to reach that milestone, we had painstakingly, person by person, utilizing a wide range of housing options, moved 460 people from these programs into their own permanent homes. Of those moved to housing, we currently have a 97% retention rate. Zooming out, I want to say that when we focus our energy on a single program, a little bit in the way that I just described, it is not unusual for those programs to be successful in their own right. But that was not an isolated effort. Hennepin County and our partners have invested in and strengthened every part of the homeless response system to ensure that it is moving more people out of homelessness at a community-wide, not just program-specific level. And what you see here is a dashboard designed for Hennepin County by HUD Technical Assistance. It tracks progress against one simple goal in this case: how many people are moving from homelessness to permanent housing across the whole community. And this chart is for single adults and youth. The blue line represents pre-pandemic outcomes. The orange line starts from October 2020, when the transformative investments in our system were just starting. We have moved almost 50% more people from homelessness to permanent housing compared to the same period before the pandemic. And every data point we look at suggests that this housing rate will continue to accelerate with sustained investment. You may have wondered about families, as I mentioned, that was single adults and youth. Our efforts to reduce family homelessness have actually seen shelter use drop by 50% pre-pandemic, and we attribute this to investments in prevention, structured shelter supports, and the targeting of housing resources. We attribute the more recent reductions to widespread rental assistance and measures around eviction prevention. We would be happy to come back and speak to this further with more time. However, those reductions in family homelessness have been offset over the years by increases in single adults experiencing homelessness, and that has been driving a dramatic increase in unsheltered homelessness. Our unsheltered count grew 377% from 2016 to 2020, and those experiencing unsheltered homelessness are at the most elevated risk from fire, infectious disease, violence, and exploitation. And I think just to kind of loop back to a comment made in an earlier discussion, Representative Gomez, you talked about how essentially one person outside is too many. So these numbers are truly appalling. And simply put, this is where our system was failing and where it most desperately needed investment and change. Now, communities up and down the West Coast offer a cautionary tale still of how much worse things can get, of course. But we are seeing in the housing data that I shared at the beginning that a different direction is possible, and we are requesting support for five key strategies. Diversion, early intervention, helping people identify and access alternative to shelter, helping avoid entering the system whenever possible. Low barrier shelters, and you will hear shortly from providers of two new shelters that were made possible with federal stimulus funds. Both were designed in response to the stated needs of people who have experienced unsheltered homelessness. New shelter construction. We have two long-term providers who need to redevelop existing programs, and these critical resources are at risk, but we can seize this moment to develop modern, purpose-built shelters with housing and services on site. 24/7 operations. It is not enough to have good new shelter programs, as existing shelters will still serve the majority of people on any given night. So all shelters need to be 24/7 to the fullest extent possible. Requiring people to leave in the morning and come back 10 hours later prevents effective work on moving people to permanent housing. The Street Voices of Change advocacy group of people who are experiencing or have experienced homelessness were instrumental in prioritizing 24/7 shelter for federal stimulus funding through the county. And finally, case management. Also a priority in the Street Voices of Change Shelter Bill of Rights. And I truly believe our work in the hotels has really acted as a proof of concept here. And that's why I wanted to highlight it at the beginning of this presentation. Dedicated case manager working alongside the individual and taking responsibility for getting them into housing as a matter of urgency. That was the formula for those 460 moves from hotel shelters to permanent housing. And at the end of last year, we expanded that team. And we started rolling it out to serve people in other homeless settings, in other shelters, in encampments. When I started developing these talking points last week, the team with that new remit had moved 90 people from homelessness to housing. This morning, I'm advised it has climbed to 107, with approximately half coming directly from unsheltered settings. And that will continue to increase in the days and weeks ahead. And this is on top of the work of our nonprofit partners, case managers. And this is the momentum we need to continue. Very briefly, of course, we know affordable housing is the fundamental issue. You've heard Hennepin County invested $46 million of ARP towards housing. That builds on an earlier $26 million used to purchase four hotel sites, which are being converted to deeply affordable housing. And we are working closely with the City of Minneapolis on approximately $35 million worth of investments from their allocation of ARP. And we've invested deeply in the initial crisis response and then the transformation of the homelessness infrastructure. Hennepin has committed more than $45 million, again, as you've heard, in ARP funding to homeless programming. That includes funding those five strategies I outlined through the federal stimulus period. But we have immediate needs for partnership on capital and operations. And further, while we are using one-time stimulus funds to the greatest extent possible, it is, I will say, unthinkable to me that once ended, we would go back to a system that relies on private donations for the majority of its operating budget and property tax for the rest. We know what that looks like. Overnight only, overcrowded, unsustainable, and inadequate to meet the needs of our most vulnerable residents. We are now on a different path, but we need help to continue on that path. And I'm going to wrap here. I wanted to share this mural in doing so. This was painted on the wall of the last hotel shelter we operated. And every time a guest moved out to their own permanent housing, they added a flower. So each flower you see on this mural represents a new beginning for someone. And this captures what we are all working towards. We appreciate your support for our efforts to date and into the future. I believe I am now handing over to Mike Gozy of the American Indian Community Development Corporation. So thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Mr. Hewitt. Rep. Petersburg, I see that you have your hand up. Are you okay to hold your question until after we hear from Mr. Gozzi and Ms. Bastian, or
yeah, that's fine. It'd be for Mr. Hewitt, but that's, we can deal with it later. That's fine.
Are you able to stick around with us, Mr. Hewitt?
Madam Chair, of course.
Perfect. Sounds good. Next up, we have Michael Gozzi. You guys will have to indulge me for just a moment. I went to high school with Mike's son, Tony. So we've known each other for a couple years. We're going to hear today about one really, you know, it's a very significant project that really reflects, you know, what we've heard over and over in this committee, that the kind of shelter that we need to meet people's needs, to meet them where they are. And so he's going to talk to us about that. But I guess I just want to share that, you know, Mr. Gozzi is the CEO of the American Indian Community Development Corporation. He has been, you know, an architect of the American Indian Cultural Corridor on Franklin Avenue. He knows how to get things done. He knows how to get deeply affordable housing built, which, as we all know, is very difficult. He knows how to run operations. He has had a role in making sure that Hennepin County Detox, which has a terrible history of abuse, particularly of American Indian members of our community, does better. And, you know, Representative Hornstein and I have both talked about, you know, that time in Minneapolis in our community in the summer of 2020, and just how difficult it was that, you know, our communities were really abandoned by all levels of government. And, you know, Mike was on Franklin Avenue all night, every night, making sure that the businesses there were protected, that the people there were safe. When the dust settled, there was one Aldi left in our community, and it was the one that the American Indian Movement Patrol protected. They protected the Midtown Global Market when it was surrounded by fire on three sides. And so, you know, Mike has just devoted his whole life to service to our community. And so it's a real honor to have you here today. Thank you for letting me gush a little bit about you, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Gozzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, everybody.
Morning. We're still morning.
Esteemed guest, really. I'm trying to get this aura off my head because I don't have an aura, and so, but it's a light above me. Thank you for all the kind words, Aisha. You know, we do go back a ways, so that's a good thing. But progress is the key. You know, for many years, the American Indian community looked for and asked for a shelter that would be culturally specific. And in 2017, I interviewed 200 homeless folks and asked them a question about if they have been in shelters. 86% of them had been in shelters within Hennepin County. When the second question was, would you go back? 89% said they wouldn't go back due to safety concerns and just feeling like they were unwelcome. And so they said they'd rather sleep outside than sleep in a shelter where they felt unsafe and unwelcome. And so when we looked at options of creating a shelter, when resources became available, AICDC jumped at the opportunity. We just thought it was something that where we needed to be. But we named it Homeward Bound because our shelter was never meant to be a permanent place. It was meant to move folks on. And I guess, you know, your own data from the state showed that Native Americans, American Indians were 27 times more likely to become homeless throughout the state. And so the work that we've done sure helps in that. I just want to share with you data because I know that's important. Outcomes are crucial. We served in 2021, our first year of existence, we served 488 folks. Of those 488 folks, we had intakes with 228 of them with case managers. And of that 228, we were able to get 68 in permanent destinations in housing, in different programs that were appropriate for their level of need, care, and really what they're willing to do. We have to work with that also. And so that's the key. One thing I've noticed is, and I've been doing this since a while, and our average age now, the highest age, the average age is 25 to 43, which is a large window, but it's a young window, and it's something that causes us some concern. So we have to look at how we address some of the needs for particularly that population. You know, I think that the other piece that really comes to place for me is that we have 11 tribes in the state of Minnesota, 11 federally recognized tribes. On a yearly basis, we serve 38 to 42 tribes. So we have, Minneapolis has always been a mecca for the surrounding states that don't have all the opportunities that we have here. And they tend to come here, and we need to help those folks get to where they need to be. I just think that the work that we've done is only the beginning. You know, we had 35 people go to treatment, which if we weren't there, that would have not happened. We are looking at reunifying families and bringing people back to the community as healthy people that are willing to do what they need to do to better their lives and themselves. And so I hope that helps.
Thank you so much, Mr. Gozy. I won't sing the Beyonce song, but all I could think of was "We Can See Your Halo" when I saw you pop up with your aura on your head. I would love it, when we're COVID safe, if we could organize a trip to come visit your facility, invite some members, just because I think it's important for us to be able to see. I'm going to ask the same thing of Ms. Bastian that I saw who just popped up on the screen, but we'll look forward to seeing you in the future, Mr. Gozy.
And the key, I see Emily too. The key is that Avivo and AAC work together, and nobody can meet everybody's needs. So by having communication and open lines of communication, we're able to meet the needs of more people. And that's really the key. I think both organizations, AICC and Avivo, are client-centered organizations. And that's where we need to be.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. See you soon. And excellent segue, because we get to hear from another one of our incredible service providers who's really risen up to the challenge of the last couple years. Thank you so much for joining us, Ms. Bastian. If you could just introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Absolutely. Madam Chair and committee members, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity. My name is Emily Bastian. I am the Vice President of Ending Homelessness at Avivo, and I am happy to be here to share with you an update on the success that has now become known as Avivo Village. It's a community success, systems success, and most importantly, it's an opportunity for individuals that have been experiencing homelessness, who were sleeping outdoors, to feel compassion, empowerment, care, support, have access, and most importantly, housing. Avivo is honored to have the opportunity to be the operator of Avivo Village, which is a model built out of the hopes and the requests and the actual words of individuals experiencing unsheltered homelessness. And you all have heard that a few times already this morning. Avivo Village is a 24/7 low barrier, harm reduction, housing focused program. It is a program, as I said, that is built to support individuals sleeping outdoors for the reasons that Mike Gozy spoke about just a couple of minutes ago. People who've been sleeping in our community outdoors in the heat of July, the cold of February, and the rain of April are indoors because of Avivo Village. And we have supported 263 unduplicated individuals since opening. And these individuals have trusted us enough to come indoors. And I emphasize trusted us enough to come indoors because my team and I don't take that lightly at all. We recognize with every single human being that comes to us that they are taking a risk and they are trusting, and we have a lot of responsibility because of that. 85% of the residents identify as individuals of color. 78% of them identify as American Indian, representing 19 tribes. Our age range is from 18 to 72 at this point. We have had, and this is a really sobering number for me, we have had 9 women have babies during the time at Avivo Village, which means that there were 9 women who were expecting, who were living outdoors, sleeping in tents and other places not meant for human habitation while carrying our community's future. And that to me is just totally unacceptable. And so, yes, we've had 9 babies born. 68 individuals housed in permanent supportive housing. And that doesn't count all of the people who have moved into other appropriate destinations, such as long-term treatment or group home settings, nursing homes, reunified with family. These are 68 people who have signed leases, gotten keys to brand new places. 69 people came to us without benefits and insurance. And we were able to get all 69 of them connected with our MNsure Navigator and with insurance. We know that this community has dies younger than their peers. We know that there are significant health disparities, and having access to insurance is significant. Another number that is very important to me, very sobering, is my team has reversed 38 overdoses successfully. We have not had a single individual pass away from a drug overdose. Human beings are being treated with dignity. They are being seen. They are being heard. They are being respected. I would like to wrap up similarly to how David Hewitt did. At Avivo Village, we have a tradition when people secure housing. And I would like to allow you to witness that. So I will ask David to share a very short video with you. I think it's only like 40, 45 seconds, so that you can join me in celebrating some of our individual success.
As loud as you can. Yeah! Good job! All right, go for it.
Woo! Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ms. Bastian. Thank you for all your work and for sharing that moment of joy with us at the end of your remarks. We really appreciate it. And we're going to try to come visit you too if you'll have us moving forward. So thank Absolutely. You so much. Great. Thanks for joining us. So that concludes the testifiers that we had signed up to speak on the bill. We'll go to member questions. Representative Petersburg, please go ahead. Thanks so much for waiting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is for Mr. Hewitt. And I want to preface it by just saying why I think it's, you know, what I'm setting it up for as to why I think it's important to ask. And that is that, you know, we spend a lot of our time dealing with the immediacy of the needs of people that are homeless. It's, I mean, they're critical. And so we have to do that. However, we also need to keep in mind that we need to reserve some of our energies for both ends of that spectrum. And so the committee is actually named Preventing Homelessness. And so we need to figure out what we can do to keep people from becoming homeless to begin with, which will then will reduce some of the need for the spectrum that we're dealing with, certainly. But there's the other side of it also, which is how we move people from homelessness and subsidized homes into their own self-dependent homes. And so that's a question I would like to ask Mr. Hewitt, because it appears that he has really kept a lot of good data, information about the progress of the people. And I'm wondering if he has any information about those that have gone into permanent housing, whether or not that's fully self-dependent or if that is still subsidized. And if it's subsidized, are there programs continuing on to help them move away from government subsidized homes into their own self-dependent homes, if he has that information?
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Mr. Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. Thank you for the question. And a couple of questions in there, and I will do my best to pass them out. And if there are a follow-up, of course, I'm very happy to answer those. With regards to kind of the, I do want to comment on kind of the both ends of the spectrum, because what you're describing there is actually exactly how we think about tackling homelessness. I think you would have heard Commissioner Connolly talk about the need to make homelessness rare, brief, and non-recurring. And we really focus on these two levers. How do we bring down the numbers becoming homeless and increase the numbers exiting homelessness? And it's only if we're pulling on both of those levers at the same time that we will see year-on-year reductions. I shared some of the statistics that were pre-pandemic. One thing I didn't share, but that I perhaps illustrates this point, is our federal point-in-time count is carried out every January. In four of the five point-in-time counts before the pandemic, the number came back basically exactly the same. It was between 3,000 and 3,100, with the vast majority being in shelter or transitional housing. But we're coming back 12 months later. All this great work has been done. How is the number the same? And the answer simply is that those two forces were in stasis. For all the people that were moving out of homelessness, they were being canceled out by new people coming in. So we need to pull both those levers if we're going to reduce these numbers year on year. But we do believe that the strategies that we put in place today, I focused here especially because they're captured within this bill, on the strategies around moving folks out of homelessness swiftly, making homelessness brief. As you say, we have to put effort into life-saving services, and you've heard from two shelters here, while people are homeless, but we need to keep that laser focus at all times on it. Our goal is to get you out of homelessness. It's not to have people living in shelters. Shelters are not places for people to live. Their goal should be to give someone somewhere to reside during that housing emergency, but to end that housing emergency as soon as possible. And that's where a lot of the measures that we've spoken about today really come in. On the prevention side, you saw that that's really been a huge part of our success in reducing the number of families using shelter. And we continue to build out those efforts. And some of the initiatives that I would highlight include the Stable Home, Stable Schools partnership in Minneapolis that is also a partnership with the Homework Starts with Home programs at a wider level, which we are now expanding to other school districts in our community. We are looking, of course, with a lot of anticipation to the potential of the local government prevention aid coming online in 2023 and the opportunity there to get more of those resources out into community to address housing instability at root so that we are pulling on that lever as well. Another piece here, we are investing federal stimulus dollars in legal representation and support at housing court. Before the pandemic, approximately a little shy of 10%, I believe, of renters coming to housing court had legal representation to put them on the same footing as everybody else and help them navigate that system. As of today, we are achieving 100% legal representation for folks coming in. So, like I said, we need to pull on both of those levers at the same time, and that's how we're going to achieve this, and I believe that's the path we're on. I do want to address the second part of your question, which is also really important, of, okay, so somebody's moved into housing, now what? This is very close to my heart. I worked in this field in the UK for a decade and became really focused on how do we ensure that people not only have a roof over their head, but that they are thriving, they have meaningful things to do, they're getting back into employment. We have committed in that $45 million of ARP dollars, approximately $3.5 million of that is for employment and training services for the people that we are moving into permanent housing. And we've contracted with a couple of providers, including culturally specific services, because our goal is that when we're moving people onto permanent housing, wherever possible, we are setting them on a path to greater things in their life. At a very minimum, we want to make sure that they are staying in housing, that the homelessness is non-recurring. We're pulling on those two levers, but the people that exit homelessness are coming back around, we've got a problem. And that's why I highlighted in that first slide that 97% retention rate, the folks coming out of our hotels. Since the summer of July 2017, we've been tracking every exit from chronic homelessness. People who've been homeless more than a year and have a disability. We passed the 1,000 mark for that earlier this year, and we have a 94% retention rate, even with that population where people are coming from 5, 6, 7, 8 years homelessness, sometimes more. The housing options themselves, many of them are subsidized through existing programs, housing support, continuum of care, but we also look at mainstream public housing resources, and we do connect people to market rate apartments, reunification with family, as Michael Gozzi mentioned. So there are a range of options there, but we really do focus on what is the retention rate, and then are we creating pathways for people to get back into employment and training wherever possible.
Thank you, Mr. Hewitt. I'll go back to you, Representative Petersburg, but I saw that Mr. Gozzi took himself off on camera, so he has a comment to add. Mr. Gozzi?
Yeah, to answer Mr. Petersburg, you know, the continuum of care really leads to jobs. You know, it's hard to take somebody that's homeless, put them in housing, and expect them to get a job immediately. We've been very successful in getting people in from homelessness, from the shelter, into supportive housing to get him more stable, very stable, and then that leads to jobs. You know, AICDC has 170 employees. Right now, two-thirds of our employees are Native American. I don't believe there's any organization besides tribes and BIA that can have those numbers. And so when we look at getting someone into housing, the goal is for them to be self-supporting, independent living, to get a job, to move their life forward. And so that is, and so there's a continuum of care. It doesn't go from 1 to 10. There are stops in between. I just wanted to share that, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Gozzi. 170 employees, is that what you just said? That's really amazing. I know he's doing two things at once, but... incredible. Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I'll just follow up with the comment that I think that's exactly what we need to do. And I appreciate the fact that we are doing some follow up, because I don't think we can say we've solved this issue or that we have reached our goal if we just get them into permanent housing. We have to go to the very end, in which they have become self-sufficient and self-supporting. And so we have to be careful not to say we've got our job done because they're in permanent housing. We need to continue going on to become so where they become self and independent. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that, Representative Petersburg. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm hoping Mr. Hewitt would answer another question for me. I thought that it was interesting to hear that the gains we've made in family homelessness, those have been offset by single adults. And I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about why that's the case. Not only, clearly, maybe we've had some success with families, but then we've had some failures with single adults. Like, probably both of those things are happening simultaneously.
Mr. Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Lee New Brindley. It's a great question. Our response to the growth in single adult homelessness, one of the things we have looked at is exactly that. It's family homelessness. This is going much better. Still, one is too many, and we want fewer children in shelter at all times, so we're not satisfied, but we've made gains. How do we make similar gains? And what is playing out differently with these populations? We also looked at veteran homelessness, and we've looked at national best practices as well. If I think about where things have gone really well with family homelessness, there are a few different things. I mean, I would say one aspect of it is a fundamental difference in the population, which is we see a much tighter link between evictions and entering shelter, literal homelessness, among families than we do with single adults. So when we put in really good support at the point of eviction, help minimize displacement of families, we see a knock-on effect in terms of the number of families entering shelter. And that's never been more evident than the last 2 years, when we've seen pre-pandemic 800 families coming into shelter, much lower than the years before, but still high. And then last year, just a little over 300. And we do think that was rental assistance and eviction prevention. We do not see as tight a link with single adults. What we see with single adults is often that their duration of housing instability before they come into the system is much, much longer, which makes that early intervention harder to target and time. So some of the prevention strategies that are effective with families do not, on the face of it, work as well with singles. With single adults, we have to look at different prevention strategies. We have to look at systems that are exiting people into homelessness. We need to look at the criminal justice system, the foster care system, these other systems. And we're doing a lot of that work in partnership across our human services department. But so that's one way in which populations are different. We've found an intervention that works with families in prevention, but that does not seem as applicable with single adults. So we're having to try different things. Then I think there is an absolute similarity in what is the result of the supports provided. What we've seen in family shelter, and let's remember, family shelter is 24/7 with staff on hand throughout the day, with case management, with a focus on getting people out and into housing. You come into a family shelter in Hennepin County, you're being scheduled for a housing assessment. You get a housing assessment, referral happens, and every step of the way, you have staff working with you. Before the pandemic, the single adult shelter system, this goes back to where I was describing it as frankly inadequate, you're coming in at 9 at night, there's 100 people in a room with a couple of advocates who are there to kind of watch over this, but they can't do client-centered work in that environment, and then people are leaving again at 9 in the morning. Fundamentally, the single adult system was not was structured just to deal with, I think it was Representative Petersburg mentioned, was only set up to deal with really that kind of health and safety emergency. It wasn't set up to create that pathway to permanent housing in the way that the family system was. So in many ways, that's what we have been replicating with the investments in 24/7 shelter, in case management, so that we can realize similar gains. And we are seeing that pay off in the numbers.
Very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Hewitt. The other thing that I was wondering as I looked at that slide was, you know, having rental assistance come online, and then also the refundable child tax credit that so many families were getting, that was like, you know, between $200 and $300 a month per child, depending on their age. So I'll be interested to see if those resources drying up have an impact on that. But Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that will be interesting to see. It seems like, I mean, as we talked about earlier, you know, there are times that we see distinct increases in homelessness or distinct sort of leveling off or even decreasing slightly. And so I'm always interested to know what is happening then. Like, is it really just, you know, we saw in 2006, was it a global recession that caused that? Or were there policy things that happened at that time to exacerbate that problem? Like, what happened? Why the increase then? And I would ask the same question now, especially with single adult homelessness. Is that exclusively a function of the pandemic? Or are there other factors at play increasing particularly homelessness among that group? Because certainly the eviction prevention and rental assistance, those things were available during the pandemic. Certainly eviction prevention was happening. I mean, that was everyone. That applied to everyone during the pandemic. So there are some things to sort of flesh out and find out there. I appreciate the presentations. I will just note, and Representative Feist, I appreciate you bringing this forward. And I will just note, I will be voting no on this bill today, but I want to tell you why. And I gave the same or a very similar explanation to Ramsey County when they came. We have so far through our bills in this committee, we have passed out $170 billion in shelter, in emergency shelter funding already. I'm sorry, $1 million in emergency shelter funding already. This is a bill for an additional $57 million overall. We just don't have a handle on where this is going and what our real goals are, and who we're trying to target and what programs are working. We just don't have a handle on that. But we have already passed out a ton of bills, spending a ton of money on this, and we got to get that figured out. And until we do, as I indicated earlier, until we do, we can just keep spending money, but we're not gonna solve problems until we really have that fleshed out. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. Members, is there any further discussion? Anyone have any questions or comments before we finish up? I'm not seeing any. So Representative Feist, I know she was having, oh, I see she's back with us. She was having some tech issues, but if you have any final comments you wanted to share, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, we have electricians in our home, and they decided now was a perfect time to cut the internet. So I raced out there, and now I'm back. So, thank you so much for hearing this bill today. Ms. Bastian should have warned me that she was going to make me cry openly during my bill presentation. I was not prepared for that. But I just think this is an incredibly important investment. I think that the data really is there that these efforts that have been funded through other means have been incredibly effective, and that this would be a wise investment. And I just think that any investment we can make that will allow everyone in our community to live their fullest life is really an important investment that we should be making. So I would appreciate a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Feist. Hearing no further discussion, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4427 be re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. And Ms. Schmidt will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Chair Gomez, aye. Vice Chair Keeler?
Keeler, aye.
Vice Chair Keeler, aye. Lee New Brindley?
No.
Lee New Brindley, nay. Heinrich?
Heinrich, no.
Heinrich, nay. Hollins?
Hollins, aye.
Hollins, aye. Hornstein?
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Howard? Howard? Cagle?
Cagle, aye.
Cagle, aye. Petersburg?
Petersburg, no.
Petersburg, no. Ryer?
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. We have 6 ayes and 3 nays.
There being 6 ayes and 3 nays, the motion passes, and Representative Feist, House File 4427, is on its way back to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. Our next meeting is Wednesday, March 30th, and there being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned. Thank you.